Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The food choices we make affect much more than what's on our dinner plates. That idea was at the core of the iconic 1971 book Diet for a Small Planet by our guest Frances Moore LePay. In that book, and in her ongoing work as an author, speaker, educator, and activist, LePay makes a case for what she calls conscientious eating, thinking about how food can not only affect our physical health, but the health of our food system, our environment, our economy, and even our democracy. Now, more than 40 years since the publication of Diet for a Small Planet, Frances Moore LePay sees many signs that our relationship to food is improving. Young farmers looking to old techniques as they try to grow and sell in a sustainable way. An expanding network of farmers markets, food co-ops, and community-supported agriculture programs that connect farmers to consumers. And a resurgence in home food growing, from tomato trellises and grapevines to beehives and chicken coops in the backyard. But LePay also sees discouraging signs. Global hunger is still a huge and ongoing problem, even as, she says, the world produces enough food to make us all full and even fat. In the U.S., millions live in so-called food deserts, areas that don't have access to healthy foods. Obesity and type 2 diabetes have become public health crises. And those challenges, LePay says, require a complete rethink of our food system. Today on The Exchange, we talk with Frances Moore LePay, and let's hear from you. Did you read LePay's book, Diet for a Small Planet, when it came out? Do you think that many of the points she makes in her book still apply today? Why do you think so much more hasn't been done yet in terms of food consciousness, global hunger, or obesity? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Frances Moore LePay is speaking at the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New Hampshire's Winter Conference this Saturday in Kingston. But first, she joins us by phone. Frances, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Brady.
One thing that has changed quite a bit since Diet for a Small Planet came out is the cultural consciousness around food. Just the idea that food doesn't just mean how we cook or what we prepare, but food is a serious topic of conversation, something for people and communities to study and discuss.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was maybe the best of my youthful intuition, that everybody loves to talk about food and everybody loves to eat, right? So why not start there and begin to unravel some of the mysteries of economics and politics that had escaped me. And so that was my beginning, just that exactly what you said.
And when did you first start to see some of those ideas from the book starting to ripple out into broader culture?
Well, the intensification has really, in my experience, has been since the mid-90s. I marked that period. I wrote a book in the early 90s in which I had chapters on various sectors of our society, and I didn't really focus on food because I didn't see the kind of breakthrough that I do today. So I mark it then. I think the birth of community-supported agriculture, that was in the 80s and beginning to take hold. The farmers market movement, yes, really started in the 90s in a big way, and now we see the 17% increase in 1 year. It's phenomenal. Yes, a quickening, an understanding of the failure of chemical and corporate dependent agriculture, that it's not working, it's not feeding the world. There are more and more people actually going hungry today. So I think there was awakening. There is an awakening going on every aspect of the question. We see more, of course, the awareness of food-related disease. How could it be that we've turned our food sustenance into a health hazard? You know, that just is so jarring to people. So, yes, I would say that's my sense of it. Since the 90s, this has really begun to change.
And there's a parallel, I think, in there, too, because at the same time that you see that awareness growing, you see that sort of as the turning point in the broader resurgence of the environmental movement. You hear, I remember the conversations going on in the late 80s about acid rain, and then the Earth Day anniversary coming up in the early 90s, and that has carried forward at the same time. So do you see a connection there?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And they are one and the same in many, many ways. As I love to point out that organic farmers, agroecological farmers, as they're called throughout the world, they are our climate heroes. And we're talking about environmental challenge, of course. Immediately, I think of climate disruption and know that one of the contributors, a major contributor, is capital chemical-intensive agriculture. And that means that the small farmers who are moving to organic practices are really our climate heroes. They can make a huge difference in meeting the climate challenge. So they're really one in the same concern and solution.
when we talk about food growing in consciousness, it's also I think of the media too. It's become a real hot topic. You know, the Food Network is actually not the only food network now. There are several channels about food. There are celebrity chefs of all kinds and food blogs all over the web. How much of that contributes to positive food consciousness, and how much do you think is it actually a problem?
Well, oh gosh, what a question. I have such mixed feelings. You know, I'm so excited about the awakening. And yet, of course, given the questions I've asked for 40-something years, why hunger in a world of plenty, of course I yearn for much more, really much more probing, much more trying to get our head around how can it be that we're producing more than a fifth more food per person than we did when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, and yet we have historic numbers of hungry people in the world. And so, you know, I'm really frustrated, too, that we're not probing more deeply into that question. How can it be? We have this great abundance, and yet it's making so many of us sick. And, you know, really asking the hard questions while we are celebrating the beauty, the glory, the sensuous pleasures of food and our reconnection with the earth. So I'd love to see a little bit more of a balance.
So do you see some of that starting to seep in, though? I mean, I think of Anthony Bourdain and his show. He does sometimes talk about some of the political ramifications of food choices and the food supply. Or do you think it's more sort of we look at sort of, you know, what cake recipe Paula Deen has up for today?
Honestly, I'm not really up on all those shows, so I can't make a judgment. Knowing me, and I would always want more of what my passion is, which is always making those connections between, as you started out saying, you know, what's best for me, my body, what's best for my taste buds, etc., is wonderfully also best for the earth. And so I'd love more and best for other people in terms of basic fairness. So I'd love those connections to be made more always. I have insatiable appetite for our working to see all those connections. And of course, around the food question, my premise is that this is a win-win-win, that what is best for us is best for others in the earth.
And it seems like there's the conundrum right there, because there is this expanding food consciousness around the country, but at the same time, the average American diet is arguably getting less healthy. So how is it that we can know more about food as it relates to our health and still be getting more unhealthy as a culture?
Well, it's not too mysterious when we understand that we are trapped into a particular way of seeing economic life. And so many of the choices then are dictated by the extreme inequalities that we've allowed to emerge in this country. Brady, that you've read some of my work, so you know that my book, EcoMind, emphasizes that we see what we expect to see and that we all see through a lens. And I'm trying to shift us from the scarcity lens to the EcoMind. And so from the EcoMind, we see relationships, and we see that we are living in an economy that is increasingly driven by concentrated economic power, which brings out the worst in human beings and also means that our food choices are increasingly limited. Because, well, actually, my favorite chapter in Diet for a Small Planet is Who Asked for Fruit Loops? And it gets right to this point, because that chapter asks you, the reader, to imagine that you are the CEO of a big food conglomerate, you know? And what are you going to do to bring highest return to your shareholders? People already have the wealth. Well, it's all the things that have happened to our food supply, the degradation, you know, from converting over to high fructose corn syrup to more and more processing to more salt that gets our taste buds hooked to, you know, just more additives, you name it. The degradation is directly related to what I call a one-rule economy. That is tolerating an economy driven by simply highest return to existing wealth. So we now have, you walk into a supermarket, and behind all those seemingly disparate labels are really 10 corporations that are bringing us half of the products in that supermarket.
We're talking with writer and activist Frances Moore LePay. In the 1970s, she pioneered the idea of conscientious eating with her cookbook, Diet for a Small Planet. Now, 40 years later, LePay says there is more awareness of the connections between food, health, and the environment, but there's also growing world hunger. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR, or you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Frances, is that why you call for so much more participation and consumer consciousness about the food that we eat? The idea you can't just leave it up to other people.
Exactly. And so, you know, you use the term conscientious in referring to me as you introduced, and I like to think of it now as I'm talking about power. I'm talking about power eating, power shopping for our food, not just conscientious, but realizing our power. Because what most excited me is now I look back as myself as a young woman, I thought, oh gosh, I don't have to be a victim anymore of food advertising. And really that is the essence here, that we can step up and realize our power to make choices based on what is best for us and best for the earth. And that means engagement, yes, but not with that heavy burden of guilt, but with a sense of I'm going to empower myself, my neighbors, my family, with education, with knowing I can make these choices, and with how I vote in terms of, you know, who I'm electing to represent me. And do they understand that we have to have a diversified, just as we understand in basic economics, you know, monopoly limits our choices. So we have to have representatives serving us in Congress and a president who understand they have to stand up to monopoly power for us to get, in any dimension of life, what we really need.
And that's going to be my next question as we come up to our first break, is the question of where the change comes from. And if I'm making a change, making those deliberate choices about what I eat, is that going to make a change on the systemic level? And that's the issue that we'll come up to when we come back from our break. So let's hear from you now. Give us a call with your questions for Frances Moore LePay. The number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR or email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back after a break.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, welcoming Jodi Picoult March 20th at the Capitol Center for the Arts on the final stop of her Lone Wolf book tour. Ticket details at gibsonbookstore.com. And from Verus Wealth Partners, a sustainable wealth management firm dedicated to aligning investors' financial objectives with their mission and values. Values Wealth Sustainability, veruswp.com. More with food writer and activist Frances Moore LePay on The Exchange on NHPR and a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, New Efforts to Stop the Bloodshed in Syria. New Hampshire weather today, clouding up across the state, highs near 35 in the north country, around 40 in central areas of the state, and 45 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of flurries or snow showers, especially in northern New Hampshire. Lows near 20 in the north country, 25 in central areas, and 25 to 30 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with food writer and activist Frances Moore LePay. She'll be the keynote speaker at the Northeast Organic Farmers Association of New Hampshire's 10th annual winter conference held this Saturday, March 3rd in Kingston. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org. We invite you to join us with your questions for Frances Moore LePay at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page and join the conversation there. Frances, when we were going into the break, I mentioned the idea of where the change has to come from, and I want to pick back up with that now. Is it going to make more of an impact on the entire food system just by me going to a farmer's market and buying local beets, or is it a policy change at the state or national level that's really going to have the biggest influence on the food system?
Well, Brady, I don't think you can separate those. I think that every time that we choose to act, what we put into our mouths, what we feed our families, what we shop for, every time we align those choices, say every time I buy organic and I go out of the way to find it, every time I buy local, every time I support and use my community-supported agriculture, I feel that I'm more aligned with my values, therefore I'm stronger, I'm more convincing, to myself and others. Other people see, you know, we're all educators. We're all shaping those who are in our lives moment to moment. They see what we do, and who knows what the ripples can be. So I think that is absolutely essential, the individual making that choice. That was the slogan of the Greenbelt movement in Africa that so changed my life. Their slogan on their T-shirt for their tree planting was simply, "As for me, I've made a choice." And it just was so powerful. So that then, of course, part of who we are is our role in this society, in this world, as citizens. So, of course, we're going to want to take those values into our choices for who we vote for. And what we advocate today happens to be Occupy the Food Supply, sponsored by Rainforest Action. And there are actions all across the country to really bring attention to everything we're talking about right here in this interview. So that's another way to express these values. So it's not an either or.
I'm curious to hear also about what you think of the deals where, say, a big food producer makes some changes to the foods to ostensibly make them healthier. You know, for example, you know, that was recently announced that some makers of children's cereals, like the Fruit Loops, like you said, they say they're going to put in more whole grains, they're going to put in less sugar. Is that a good thing?
Well, from what I've read, most of those are absolutely empty claims. Absolutely empty. In fact, some of the products that then they tout as more healthy are even worse. So I don't think that that's the solution. I do believe that whole foods really shifting through our own choices and through policy choices so that we have more and more producers of whole foods, that is the direction, not slightly making processed foods maybe, you know, a little better. So I think that, it's really staying with our eyes on the prize.
I wanted to ask you one more question about policy choices, because I was thinking as you were talking about the issue of recycling, and in most New Hampshire towns, you had the option to recycle, but the rate stayed low until towns started to require it, and then all of a sudden they shot up. So can we simply just hope that over time through education that we'll turn the food system into something more sustainable, or is it really going to take policy choices to jumpstart that?
Well, I think certainly in agriculture that policy changes, yes, you know, there are now, you know, more people wanting to become farmers. I just read that applications for enrollment in ag schools has gone up 20% over just a three-year period. So this is, you know, there is movement that is happening. Yet we know, if we look at Europe, for example, it's been when the public has put more resources into supporting, say, the transition of farming to organic, that we've seen huge changes. Now almost 19% of Austrian farmland, agricultural land, is organic. Switzerland, 11%, I think. But this is people making public choices to support this transition. And I think that has to be part of it. And that means then all of us being better educators to understand that organic farming is the only real solution to the world's problems in terms of food, because chemical and corporate-dependent agriculture has failed to feed the world and impoverishes farmers. So I think we have to even work harder to crack the myths that somehow organic means moving backward, or that it's simply an indulgence. No, it is the future, and it is now proven to produce the volumes that we need, but most important, the healthy volumes that we need in terms of food.
And the role that institutions play, aside from the government or food producers, is important too. I was reading something by author Michael Pollan. You know, he wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma and other books. And he said the food movement can be more successful with a powerful partner. And he said the healthcare system is the one seeing the effects. And with help from the healthcare system, that pushes the dynamic considerably. If hospitals and doctors are saying, look, we all need to eat healthier, and we're going to do something about that, then that comes into play as well.
Yes, and I think our waking up as a population to understand the untenable cost to, and this is what I think Michael Pollan is getting at as well, that we see the health care costs of this diet are just untenable. We can't afford to eat this way. It just is too costly in terms of medical care, not to mention the human suffering at the base of it and so much of it for our children.
Let's take a call now from one of our listeners. Bonnie in Keene is with us here. Bonnie, you are on The Exchange.
Hey, thanks. First of all, I just wanted to say I look forward to meeting you at NOFA New Hampshire this weekend, Francis. And I was wondering if you could speak to the role of cooperatives, you know, both specifically food co-ops, but cooperatives in general, what role they play in this vision you presented for our future.
Great question. Francis.
Great question. Thank you. Yes, this is the International Year of the Co-op, the UN International Year. So what a great moment to talk about cooperatives. And we see that they have a powerful, powerful role to play here and around the world. Of course, perhaps the most dramatic example in the U.S. in my life was, you know, meeting a handful of farmers in western Wisconsin in 1988 who said they wanted to start a dairy co-op and because everybody was going under. And I thought, oh, how sweet. You know, that's really nice for some farmers in western Wisconsin. Little would I have ever predicted that today that company, you may guess who I'm talking about, Organic Valley, is now, you know, a $700 million business, 1,700 farmers around the country, and it's a democratic co-op. And the reason that it's so successful is precisely that it's stayed true to those values of one farmer, one vote, not $1, one vote. And we see that same impact in for example, India, where all we hear about is high-tech, you know, success. Actually, women co-op leaders in rural India have created a dairy network there that has, you know, just created something like a fifth of the whole dairy output in India and has created many more jobs than what we read about in the high-tech industry in that country. So co-ops are essential. Food co-ops, actually, there's a big uptick in numbers of food co-ops being formed today. And the first big upsurge in my lifetime was in the 1970s, and now we're seeing another uptick. So that's all very, very positive.
Bonnie, thank you so much for the call. That brings up another issue, Francis, that I was wondering about. I mean, when you hear the term food co-op, you think, well, that's probably a small place. It's nice to have good stuff, possibly expensive, but it's kind of a niche. It's nice to have, but it's not really part of the broader food system.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Certainly in the Harvest Co-op in Cambridge, I live in Boston, and I see a whole range of people shopping there, and in terms of its, you know, think about being in a small town in Wisconsin and looking for the co-op, and I couldn't see it for the longest time because I was expecting to see a little storefront, and actually it was this huge, beautiful store. So co-ops have really changed a lot since over the last 30 or 40 years, and I think becoming much more part of our culture, and that just thrills me no end because it is a direct response to monopoly control.
And it also begs another question, or it prompts another question, rather, that food access. If you have a co-op in your town, fantastic, you have access to healthy food. I was looking this morning at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's online map of food deserts, areas where residents don't have access to healthy food. You know, the inner city may not have a grocery store, or someone in a rural area might have to drive 30 or 40 miles to get to a place that does. The Northeast does pretty well. New Hampshire does relatively well, but there were a lot of dots on that map. There's sort of an infrastructure that's missing in those places that an individual consumer or even a group of consumers can't build alone, or can they?
Yeah, well, this is a reflection of the growing inequality in our country, economic inequality that's so extreme. You know, we have greater inequality than Yemen, just to give you one example. So that's what you're really is reflected in that map. It's horrific, and I don't want in any way to undercount the the challenge. But I one of the things that so inspires me now is seeing inner cities break through this through incredibly creative solutions. One of the groups I'm following for their impact is called Growing Home in Chicago, which started out maybe 20 years ago, but really welcoming people who are coming out of prison, welcoming people who have been homeless to learn community gardening and to learn the skills they need to work in the food industry. And it's been remarkably successful in getting people on their feet. And now it's grown into a whole community-wide movement to, as they say, turn our part of Chicago from food desert to food destination. And so Growing Home, I welcome any listener to look it up on the web, is really a model for what can be happening even in this extreme state of inequality.
It even reminds me of there are some efforts, I think, around New York and New Jersey where there are stores who don't have access to healthy food, so they build greenhouses on the roofs, and they just go upstairs and grab the food and bring it back down into the store, so they get their local food that way. Let's take another call, Francis. This is Neil in New Hampton. Neil, welcome to The Exchange.
Well, thank you. So, Francis, first I want to say I've read almost every book you've written.
Wow.
And I own all three copies of Diet for a Small Planet, all the revisions, and I would recommend you write your, I guess it would be your 40th anniversary revision. But isn't it true that we need to move toward a plant-based diet and away from animal-based diet in order to be truly sustainable, both planetary, environmentally, and personal health?
Big question there. Thank you, Neil. Francis?
Yes, I'm glad that you said plant-centered because, as you know, and thank you so much for that vote of confidence, you know that that's my preferred term. Actually, I've started calling my diet plant and planet-friendly diet, which I think is really important to create that big tent that one doesn't have to be a vegetarian. I am, but one doesn't have to be to follow this diet. And I think on all those counts, on our personal health, our vitality, on the benign relationship with the earth and the maximum potential for all of us to thrive, that this makes most sense. So that's really the core argument that hit me and so excited me as a 20-something, and it still does. And then it was heresy, and now it's more and more the canon medical professionals who are encouraging people to move to a plant-centered diet. So I totally agree with you.
Neil, thanks so much for the call. Here's a question that sort of follows up on that, Francis. What about the issue of hunting? I know vegetarians and even some vegans who say, I don't eat factory processed meat or factory farmed meat, but if I go hunting, I consider that sustainable because it helps stabilize animal populations in the wild and eliminates the possibility of them starving. It's different in that way than having chickens in small cages or having cows in unsanitary conditions. They almost consider it like foraging for mushrooms in a way. What's your take on that issue, hunting as a sustainability issue?
Hmm. Well, I guess I'd prefer not to particularly dive in there. To me, it's not the focus of my work, and it's clearly an ethical question about how one feels about killing animals that we don't need to kill to survive ourselves. So it's just not where I want to put my energy right now on trying to figure. I mean, it's just obviously unnecessary. I guess that's the previous caller underscores that we do so well in a plant-centered diet.
The Exchange phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Francis, what you started to touch on about the ethics of food, is, and that's something that, you know, that come up that people can often get a little bit defensive about, that idea that no one wants to feel like he or she is being judged. You made a burger when you could have had arugula and goat cheese on artisan bread. The resistance can go right up. So how do you encourage people to move to a more plant-based diet without invoking guilt or anything like that?
Right. It doesn't work. Guilt doesn't work. Preaching doesn't typically work when it comes to this. So I think, and I hope that this is the spirit in everything that I write and say, the spirit of welcome the experience the expression of, wow, this is so fantastic. Why don't you try it? And that is what happened to me when, back in my 20s, when I changed my diet, it was all about excitement and discovery on reading these plant-centered, plant recipes, really. They were so exciting. It was almost like reading a novel. I would say, oh, you mean that can go with that and that? Let me try that. And so that, I think, is the spirit of adventure, the spirit of being feeling better ourselves, and both ourselves and about ourselves, but not with the wagging finger, but with the welcome sign.
Let's take one more call. Jonathan is calling from Norwich, Vermont. Hi, Jonathan. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thank you very much. I think, you've partly answered in response to the last few questions and the last caller, but I'm interested in how in the, let's call it the empowered and conscientious food movement, there are a couple divergent wings towards the extremes. There's on the one hand the vegan community, which to my perception has grown extremely fast in the last few years. I had never even heard the word until, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And then on the other hand, there are those who follow the advice out of the Weston Price Foundation, sort of a renegade nutrition movement, who argue that things like cholesterol in your diet is not a problem whatsoever, and that saturated fats can be healthy and really not the conventional nutritional advice, and advocate a diet that's heavy into meats and those sorts of things. Although they also argue that the meat should always be raised in an organic and free-range manner.
Jonathan, I'm just going to jump in to give Frances a chance to respond before our next break.
Well, I think the extremes are still a small portion of the overall shift, and what I want to keep my eyes on is this huge, huge percentage of people who are now in the standard processed and meat-centered world, and to show opportunity for this other pathway of a whole foods, plant-centered diet that is so incredibly delicious and can become more and more accessible to people, and really welcome them to that rather than spend my time arguing around the edges of that.
We'll pick that up right after our next break. More with Frances Moore-LePay to come up on The Exchange.
The legacy one leaves for a community can last for generations. I'm Anna Moskoff, Plan Gifts Officer at NHPR, and I'd like to talk to you about the many ways in which you can support NHPR, like leaving a gift through your estate. You can make a lasting impact on this new service for the next generation of public radio listeners in New Hampshire. For more information, please call 800-639-4131 or visit the support page at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making. PaxWorld.com for tomorrow. New Hampshire weather today, clouding up across the state with high temperatures near 35 in the North Country, around 40 in central areas of the state, 45 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a panel of people in New Hampshire with ties to Syria talk with us about the crisis in their home country. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, Frances Moore-LePay talks with us about food, health, and the global environment. She is the author of the iconic book, Diet for a Small Planet. And now, 40 years later, she says there is more awareness of the connections between food, health, and the environment, but also growing world hunger. Join us with your questions and your comments by calling 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Frances, I wanted to give you a chance to finish up with what you were saying right before the break.
Well, I was thinking about the question and realized that what I want to really focus in on is that so much of the problem that we're experiencing, talking about today in terms of how our dominant food system is making us ill and not and the world hungry, that this theme of my current book called Eco Mind, Thinking Like an Ecosystem, what is the advantage of thinking like an ecosystem? The idea here is thinking in terms of relationships and what is, you know, in an ecosystem, the expression, the success of any organism depends on its context. And so I'm really encouraging us to look at what are the dynamics of power in our current social ecosystem that so concentrate wealth at the top that we end up with such a degradation of our food, as well as a farming system that, you know, really only the top 1% of, only the top 10% of farmers can earn enough from farming, you know, to support a household. So to really use food as an entry point, sort of, as I began my work, you know, to really see the whole ecosystem that is producing this hunger amidst plenty.
And as you say, that more thinking like an ecosystem and more of those relationships can actually start to deal with the huge problem of global hunger. And as we look at the global picture, I mean, you hear about a billion people being hungry every day, and you think to yourself, well, what does a farmer's co-op really possibly say that could answer a problem this big? But you're saying the solution really is in there. How so?
Yes. Yes. I gave you, you know, that beautiful example from India where the dairy co-ops are so important to poor rural farms. And India is a great example of the change that you're talking about, Brady, worldwide. In Andhra Pradesh, which is a big southern state in India, this state so bought into the chemical model that some called it the pesticide capital of the world. And yet 10 years ago, small farmers started saying, no, this is not working for us. We're, you know, a third of our costs are paying for pesticides and fertilizers, and we're ending up with no profits, and we're getting sick. And this monoculture means we don't have the diversified food our bodies need. And so they started saying, no, 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 we want to start sharing seeds, saving seeds, and planting without pesticides, without using without chemical fertilizers and pesticides. And as a result, now 8,000 villages have made this conversion or are in the process of. And it's led by almost a million women self-help groups across the state. And so this is an enormous shift that directly addresses the roots of hunger, because a lot of these farmers were among the hungriest people in the state. They were so indebted because of the chemical and corporate dependent approach that they couldn't feed themselves.
It also reminds me that in some parts of the world where farmers are living a subsistence life, that that little details and little pieces can add up in a big way. I'm thinking of in Africa, Niger, and in parts of Mali, the reforestation projects in areas that might otherwise have been swallowed up by the Sahara are starting to be preserved or even reconstituted. They're starting to come back to life, and farmers can grow more crops.
Exactly. Niger is an amazing story in that regard. Over 12 million acres have been re-greened by small, poor farmers with trees, using agroforestry, which we now know is a huge part of the solution to climate change, and have re-greened with 200 million trees, re-established those trees, and now helping to secure the food security of over 2 million people. So it's a great example, Niger is.
Does it just boil down then to a little bit of education? I mean, the small farmers are barely getting by, so they often see the trees on their land as obstacles. Cut them down, I can get more farmland, I can grow more crops, but it turns out to be the opposite case.
Yes, yes. And this whole idea of agroforestry, as you say, of seeing trees as an advantage, is now a key part of what many appreciate in the agroecological farming world. And so I think we're going to see more and more of that. And yes, a big part of that is education. It is also in the state of Andhra Pradesh, as I mentioned. It also had to do with the state began to see that this was the solution and began to support with extension agents. Many of the farmers, they helped to make them then who were doing this great work, they became extension agents. And so there was some public support behind this education.
Can every place on Earth, though, end up sustaining itself with local food? I mean, I think of a country like Haiti, where the deforestation has been so prevalent and so massive that farmland has been eroding away. Are there any places where even the biggest optimist has to say, yeah, we're probably going to have to write it off, it's not going to come together here?
Well, I think it's over what time period we're talking. I don't think, I mean, not too long ago, as you probably know, Haiti was self-sufficient in rice, for example, and that was completely done in by our exports that wiped out their producers. Deforestation was a human-made phenomenon. So I've been just, you know, vastly impressed at how quickly this reforestation can take place, even, as you say, in an area in Africa threatened by the spread of the Sahara. So I wouldn't write off any part of the world until we've really tried, and we certainly haven't even begun to try in Haiti.
One of the arguments that often comes up in opposition to local food is the idea that it's going to limit the amount of choice that you have. You know, if you live in the Northeast, you're going to eat a lot of apples, but you're not going to eat a lot of bananas. Or if you live in southern parts of the country, maybe you'll eat a lot of oranges, but you're not going to get a lot of maple syrup. Is there a balance in there where we can still have our bananas in the Northeast?
Yeah, for me, it's really the direction that we're headed, and not you know, I've said this maybe too many times in this interview, but, you know, not focusing on the difficult questions, so, you know, that are really a small part of our diet, and focus on the bulk of what we can do and really emphasize that shift first. And in the Northeast, there's so much that could happen if we put our attention and some public resources to it. We know that it's possible we have the simple technologies available to grow more food during the cold months. And so, you know, moving in that, really doing all that we can in that direction, rather than talking about bananas. I mean, I don't mean to be offensive, but do you know what I'm trying to say?
That absolutely,
really,
sure.
On what's possible.
I also wanted to, and you mentioned about the Northeast, we'll talk about it in particular. It does seem like things have picked up, at least in New Hampshire. We're talking about, you know, we have winter farmers markets now in the North Country. And that's something that, you know, 5 years ago was not discussed and wasn't talked about. We're seeing this much, much larger sort of sense of regionalism and people getting their food together.
Yeah, I've noticed that, and I hope to learn a whole lot more about it on Saturday, too. That's very exciting.
Let's take a call now. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR. Christy is calling in from Franconia in the North Country. Christy, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi there. Hello?
And your question.
Well, I run into a lot of people who say, I have to go to Walmart. I just can't afford not to, and then they go to Walmart and they buy packaged food that has no life force. What do you say to these people?
Francis, big question.
I think your best argument is yourself, and what you exude about the vitality that you have by the diet choices that you're making, and, you know, even talking about how to make it economical, how you are making it economical, and just sharing that. We were talking earlier about the fact that human beings don't respond too well to being preached at, and I'm not in any way saying that's what you do, but I'm just underscoring that it's the vitality, the excitement, the joy that you are exuding about the choices that you're making that then people say, oh, I want some of that, you know. I want some of that energy that she has. And and sharing, you know, your good dishes with them whenever possible, and, you know, really encouraging that shift and showing, you know, one of the things I did not too long ago was a little Excel sheet for myself of taking what are the calories and costs and nutrients from, you know, a pound of hamburger and a pound of potato chips versus a pound of rice and a pound of black beans. And of course, the black beans and rice came down, you know, way ahead in terms of all the measures of cost and calorie, the amount of calories, the amount of nutrients, the low cost. And, you know, just the more we can expose people to the possibility of healthy, delicious, plant-centered diets, I think that's the way to go. And any way that we can do that in a positive way is success for me.
Thank you so much, Christy, for that call. Here's an email that we got from John Francis. I want to share this with you. He says, much of the latest research on paleo nutrition, diabetes, heart disease, and obesity contradicts the claims of vegetarians. Research increasingly shows that we evolved to eat animals and particular animal fats, and that a vegetarian diet is not healthy. Rather, it's a form of malnutrition. He says, I understand the ideological wishful thinking of vegetarians, but how do we resolve the conflict between politically correct eating and human evolution?
Well, the research that I've seen, and certainly my medical checkups, I have really great blood counts on all nutrients that they measure for, and I'm a healthy person. So I'm one person, though, of course. But the studies that I've seen show greater longevity, I believe. I haven't looked at it so long because it seemed like it was kind of settled that a plant-centered diet was healthier. And here again, I'm talking about a plant-centered diet. Because, you know, that's what, you know, Dr. Willett at Harvard or many others have advocated as well. And so there's a lot of science behind that a meat-centered diet, certainly a red meat diet, is probably the worst for every disease that we can think of. So I don't think there is a conflict at all between what science is now telling us about what's best for our bodies and what is best for the earth, which is this plant-centered approach.
John, thank you so much for that email. And that reminded me of a question that I was wondering about, Francis. You were talking about meat diets, and there are parts of the world that were primarily plant-based diets. I'm thinking in Asia, especially in China. Now, with globalization taking root, we're starting to see more and more people in China adding meat to their diet in a much bigger way. Even France, which, you know, has the sacred reputation among foodies, they're seeing their obesity rates get higher and higher. Is this a case where you confront these issues in America and then you're going to have to start all over again in other countries because the problems have exported themselves overseas?
Yes, I think your facts also address the previous caller's question because, yes, as diets move toward a meat-centered, health outcomes worsen. But again, to me, this is a symptom of this deeper pattern of a highly concentrated food industry, a highly concentrated food marketing. You see advertising for McDonald's and junk food all around the world now. So I'm not sure what's natural about this shift. I think it is a symptom of a deep, deep inequality, and we know that human beings are susceptible to suggestion, and certainly when we're bombarded with advertising telling us that a meat-centered diet is better, and that's what happened here. Advertising began to shift us toward believing that a grain-fed, meat-centered diet was healthy. So, again, this appreciation for what is best for our bodies has got to come to fruition, to realization, as we also address the economic inequities that so distort the public debate and the public consciousness about food. So I just couldn't stress more that it's all of a whole here so that our political choices matter as much as our individual food choices.
As we wrap up here, I just have one last question for you briefly. Diet for a Small Planet came out in 1971. Let's look ahead 41 more years. Are we still going to be moving in two opposite directions at the same time?
Whoa. I can only say, in EcoMind, I say I'm not an optimist or pessimist. I'm a possibilist. And so as a possibilist, I will answer. I will answer that it is certainly possible that right now, as we speak, in 2012, that we are on the cusp of an awakening to a global shift to appreciation of agroecological approaches and a relocalization of food, because it's what we need to address climate change and clearly what our bodies need and what our psyches need and our cultures need in terms of local empowerment and respecting of cultures. So this is a global awakening that could just take off. The stories I told you from, you know, from Africa or from India, and you have many right there in New Hampshire, this could really begin to shift as we explode the myth that corporate and chemical agriculture works. It's not feeding the world, and it's making us sick. So that is a powerful thing to bust through.
Well, Frances, thank you so much for your time today. It's been great talking with you.
My great delight, Brady. Thank you for the opportunity.
Frances Morlepay is the author of a number of books, including the bestseller Diet for a Small Planet. She's speaking at the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New Hampshire's winter conference this Saturday in Kingston. For more, just visit our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Canoy.